Welcome to Addiction to Recovery. Our purpose and passion is to bring you not only the science of addiction,
but also the patient perspective and how the two relate. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Addiction to Recovery. My name is Josh Solem. I'm a certified peer recovery specialist, and I'm joined by Dr. Heather Bell, addiction and family medicine. I almost got it that time. It's addiction.
Physician.
Okay. So it's been a little bit of time since we've done a solo one, and one of the topics that we have kind of left on the table, and it's one of the more important ones when talking about addiction, is the groups that people go to. And we've talked about treatment, but we haven't talked about kind of the original one, and that is the model of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes, and we've had it on our list from the beginning. I think We've just met fun people that wanted to tape with us, and so we haven't done it. I have the sun in my eye, so I'm going to kind of wiggle around here a little bit. But yeah, so I think...
Speaking of the sun, by the way, we should mention, just for like historical reasons, it's January 31st, and it's like t-shirt weather outside in Minnesota.
It's 51 degrees right now.
It's 51 degrees, and it feels really like spring. So I don't know. I just thought I'd mention that. It was very random, but it's weird. So I mean, I guess the seasonal depression isn't as bad, I guess, since it's.
So I think the thing I want to start by saying before we kind of get into this is, first of all, we're going to have another episode where we are going to explain what the 12 steps are for people who don't know. We're not going to go into like nitty-gritty details. Obviously, this is an anonymous type thing, so it's all going to be very high level. But I think to people who've never been to an AA meeting, or people who, family members who go or whatever, you always hear about these 12 steps. But, what are they?
But they withstood the test of time.
The other thing I want to say before we start talking is that this is not the only way to achieve whatever recovery journey is your goal in sobriety and whatever. This one's important because it is the first one. And it has a big old historical component. And I would say it's been well studied, but it hasn't, because that's one of their things, that you don't study it. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to talk about it, and you're going to talk about some offshoots of it. And just to make known, there are other, Celebrate Recovery is another type of group that is not AA based. So I just want to say that.
Yeah. And before we go any further too, I do want to say that I did a lot of thinking about how to address this and how to talk about it, because the anonymity of the program, and I don't know what the stances are, but I looked at it and I'm like, there's all this information on the internet. You can find out any of this information. I think when they talk about it, I'll read, there's a set of traditions that they have that they set up the same time they set up the 12 steps. And one of the traditions, it says, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. So I think what they're saying is that if somebody was involved and was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they frowned upon them going on the news or going into media and saying, my name is Bill Wilson and I'm in AA.
Right.
And I think part of that is because the AA name is more important than the individual. And so if somebody's out there and a lot of times people can give a bad name to treatments. And I think that's why like big treatment centers aren't that fond of people going out and saying, hey, they cured me, or because then there's the situations where they go out and fail, and the reality is
or that, return to use. Let's not call it failing.
That was bad, but the reality is that more return to use than don't, and
right,
and the stats or whatever you can pull up, I mean, they do favor AA. I mean, for the studies they have, they do favor AA when it comes to this. But
when I think you just kind of said it. It's more about this fellowship of, of who it is, and that it's a bunch of people who get together to, you know, other peers to talk through all sorts of different things. And it's not about the individual person, because there's a lot of people there, and it's kind of shared experience. It's shared strength. It's shared ideas and growth and hope. And that is ultimately what's behind it. They don't make big partnerships with other organizations. They don't affiliate themselves with, what is it, with institutions. They don't, you know, now individual people obviously can support different things, but nobody gets to stand up and say, I'm affiliated with this political institution on behalf of AA. That just isn't allowed, basically. Right. So the whole thing is they want to avoid any controversy. Don't endorse or oppose any cause. The whole idea is we are coming together. Yeah. Strength and hope with each other that they may shine or may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. No, that was the original tenant. But.
Right. And what they found, and I'll get into this a little bit later here, but the story of the founder, the founders is quite remarkable. And it's one of the first things you learn about when you go into treatment. It's a requirement when you go into certain treatments to read the first, I think it's 38 pages of the big book. And that is the history, or that's like Bill Wilson's story. So it was groundbreaking, and then it also was like the platform for building on addressing this issue, because let's not forget that back then alcohol was, you know, considered a drug in a way. Mm-hmm. Prohibition. People were treated like they were insane when they would be actually alcoholic, and they would be locked up in mental institutions. They all died eventually. Yeah. But I mean, a lot of them didn't get any help, and the help that they got was like, you know, doctors that didn't know what to do.
Right.
Cause there's no real, like, you know, you can't like pinpoint something to attack it.
Yeah, so when was it started? 1935.
Yep.
I think it's ironic that it started in Ohio, just because of the whole opioid epidemic. And, you know, Ohio is kind of one of the hotspots. Yep. So by Bill Wilson, who was the New York stockbroker.
Yes.
And then Dr. Bob. Was a surgeon. So they both passed, but they actually called themselves, quote, hopeless drunks.
They were, yeah, they're very openly about it. And there's such a story about this, but I want to just mention, because I don't want to like misquote it or not do it correctly, because it's been a while since I've read up on this and watched this movie, but there's a movie out there and I highly encourage people to get it. It's called My Name is Bill W. And I haven't looked it up. Maybe Heather's doing that right now, but I don't know if it's on any streaming services. I remember when I got out of a treatment center one time, I went to the public library and they had it on DVD, and that's how I watched it. That's how I actually wanted my family to watch it. So I encouraged them to watch it. And it's actually not like this low budget thing. It's got not Gene Hackman. It's got, James Woods and
James Garner
as the two, that was, Bill and Dr. Bob.
Yep. And it was release date was April 30th, 1989.
So these guys weren't just nobodies. They got and I'm not sure.
It's on Amazon Prime.
Okay, Amazon Prime. There you go, free plug.
Emmy award winning.
It's really remarkable. It lays it out how it happened. You know, 1935, Akron, Ohio. These two gentlemen. Bill Wilson was actually, you know, a traveling salesman. So that's how he would drink, and he would just get bombed, and it shows the backstory about how crazy he would get. It was like he was night and day. He was brilliant. He was actually one of the most sought after brains in the world of science. I think it was Einstein or Edison or somebody that wanted him to work for them, but he showed up drunk for his first day, something like that. But anyway, he was out in some, you know, sales trip, and he was at a hotel and he had stopped drinking. You know, his wife had, and they had back and forth, and he was really trying, and he was calling around to these churches, because there was a bar in the hotel that he was at, and there was a payphone, And he went into the bar and got changed to bring to the payphone, you know, dramatically. They thought you were going to. So he just called churches asking for anybody if they knew anybody that was alcoholic. And he finally got to one church, and the lady said, you know, I know this doctor in town that's had this problem. And they went and they got together and they sat at Dr. Bob's house at his table and talked all night and didn't drink. And they hadn't talked with coffee and, you know, probably cigarettes, just for the whole idea of Alcoholics Anonymous, a bunch of guys sitting around drinking terrible coffee and smoking cigarettes. But that was what they did at the time. And, you know, it came to be like, I don't know, like 4 a.m. or something, what they said. And they're like, we realized that we didn't want to drink. You know, we started out wanting to drink, and talking to each other made us not want to drink. Hmm. And so that's how it all started. And then they started, like, again, two brilliant men. And it was like this light bulb that went off, and they're like, wow, I think I know how to fix people, or I know how to help people. And you know, you're a doctor, you know, you want to help people. And Bill Wilson is this guy that had struggled so mightily. And even before that, he was out trying to rescue people. You know, he'd go out in the streets and get somebody that was drunk and bring them to their house and try and get them sobered up. And that was what was keeping him sober at one time. Hmm. That was before he met Dr. Bob. So that he had the idea of helping other drunks was how he was going to get sober. But once he realized that two people wanting to get sober together, it was the support that he needed. And so then they started to go to different hospitals and ask doctors, is there anybody in here that's in here on an alcohol issue that's like deemed beyond hope? And they found one guy, and I don't remember what his name was. It might have been Bill, too. But they sat at his bedside and talked to him about his drinking problem until he said, I really don't want to drink anymore now that I met you guys. So, I mean, it's
okay, that's
pretty
just
cool.
Super ironic that they went to the hospital and asked that, because I'm just going to – I've said it on a different episode at some point. But there are more people in our hospitals in the U.S. right now admitted for alcohol-related trouble than are in and admitted for heart disease.
That's crazy. Right now? Like today?
Like, yeah. So
that's underreported, you know,
way underreported. And I mean, I think the whole idea that the only requirement to be able to go to AA is that you have a desire to stop drinking or using or whatever the heck it is. Mm-hmm.
That's the one that always gets me every time when I go through this list, is that the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop. And that's different than I have stopped. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, you can go in there under the influence. You can't bring anything in there with you. But if you've been drinking and you're like, I don't want to drink anymore. Like, you don't have to be clean to go in there.
And this is where there's a lot of, I don't say controversy, but there's a lot of discussion I've heard from patients on this topic. And now these discussions that I had about AA with the patients I'm about to talk about are all patients who were not struggling with alcohol. They were struggling with opioids or meth or something else. And that's where I think there's people who can kind of question this idea that you don't have to be sober yet. I mean, I totally understand the why you don't have to. I mean, it totally makes sense. But for someone who's early in recovery and someone walks in under the influence, that can be a trigger.
It can be. But the thing is that you're surrounded by other people that are.
Exactly. I just want to throw that out there, because people will argue, I don't want to go to those meetings because it's triggering for me if other people are there.
And that's, you know, that's the thing is it's perfectly fine to have, you know, some meetings are different. You know, you go to like some meetings in the higher populated cities. You're going to have a higher risk of seeing somebody that's maybe triggering to you. You know, somebody that maybe is not quite taking the program the way you want to take it. Mm-hmm. And
but then if you're in a small community, you might run into people you've used with.
Yes. And that's true too. But I mean, again, you can do that in treatment just as well, mm-hmm. you know, and the idea that it is the desire to stop drinking. And that has to be like, emphasize though, because I mean, if you're just going, and they'll take you if you're going because your wife said no more, you know, and then you're like, okay, I'll just go to this AA meeting, you might learn something,
right?
You know, that's the thing, is that there's been many a times when I've been at meetings and people just brought somebody with, and they would, and I just outed myself there, but I've been to meetings, I'll just say that, but they would they would come in and they would say, I'm Josh. I'm not sure what I am, because you basically go around and you identify yourself as alcoholic or in recovery or whatever. But, you know, there'd be people that come in there and say, you know, I drink. I just don't know if I have a problem. Right. And they're just curious. But they have these things. They label them. You know, there's women only meetings. There's closed meetings, which mean that they're only for people that are alcoholic or in recovery. And then there are open meetings where you can bring family members. You can bring somebody that's curious. You can bring support people. So there are those labels associated with the meetings themselves. But I think that it's so important to realize how many, this is the one thing that sets them apart from any other treatment center, is that you can find one any time of the day if you work at it, you know. I mean, granted, overnight in the middle of the night is probably not going to be.
Although during COVID, you could Google this. They had online meetings. I had patients saying, man, I went to a meeting in like
Portugal.
Right. I mean, you have to like look at what language they're speaking, but yeah. they had Zoom meetings. Now, obviously, you kind of lose a lot of that camaraderie sitting in a room together.
I think they still do.
But if you're really struggling and it's 2 a.m, you can Google that and find something.
Right, which is a great asset and a great resource for people. If you really have the desire, and there's always something out there for you.
And that's what's really neat to me, is that you can find, I don't know, I have data here somewhere about how many there are. And this, I don't know when this piece of literature came out, to be honest, it doesn't even have a date on it, but it says on here that there are more than 114,000 groups and over 2 million members in over 180 countries.
And I think that's probably old.
This is way old, because look at this paper.
But I think that they just keep
growing
and growing. And
that's what I was going to say. That's the neat thing, is that the premise of AA is universal. Yes, you could have these little offshoots, which we'll talk about in a second, but the underlying, here is AA and here is what it is, should be essentially, or is essentially, the same no matter where you are.
Right. And that's what it is. You know, that's the amazing part for me. When I first learned of this, first of all, it was like, wow, this is profound. Some of this stuff is just brilliant. Like, it makes so much sense. I actually think that everybody should read the book, the big book, they call it the big book in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so brilliant. And it's in 1935. And you know, they'll re-release it because in the back, well, now it's 2/3 of it is stories. People write in I read one this morning. It was just wild. It was a pharmacist that was talking about how he would have to like drink so much and then hit himself with uppers and then put himself to sleep with like a propofol. And it was crazy, but that's offshoot. So anyway, it does say 2.1 million members as of today. But that, you know, that's one of those things that you got to look at, is that's official membership. I mean, there's people that go all the time that never like become official, don't like register.
But let's just say like an official member, there's no dues. It's not like you have to pay your membership dues annually and you get like whatever. So membership, that's something to remember though, is that there's nothing that, you know, hinges on membership. Right. You don't get anything special. You don't have to. Yeah, I like this. The maximum contributed by any member annually is $3,000.
Yeah.
So there's not like a pot of money. It's self-run within that group.
And it's, you know, the thing is that it's stood the test of time, like you said, like we stumbled over, but it literally is, they haven't really changed much. You know, some of the philosophies, I think, and this is my own opinion, they need to adapt to the new things that are out there to help. For instance, peer support. Again, that's what I do. It could be looked down on by somebody in the groups of these Alcoholics Anonymous programs, because it is professionalized help and somebody's getting paid to help somebody.
So there's a couple of things. I'm glad you said that, because part of AA, you know, is these 12 steps, which we'll get to at some point. And then part of it is the sponsor. And, you know, sponsors are people that you typically, is a person you typically meet at an AA meeting. You go to the AA meetings until you find someone that's there and you happen to click with them, or you like what they're saying, or like how they say things. And, you know, they've been in recovery for X amount of time or whatever. And then you ask them to be your sponsor. Well, that looks like they help you work the 12 steps.
Right.
They help you with that. And that is like their purpose in a way. You know, they're not, you know, they're the phone number you can call when you're in a pinch or when you're struggling. And so they're there. So whereas peer support, you know, you don't have like, here's your 12 steps, you have to do this. You know, right. You're helping navigate systems and helping support them. Yeah, you might still be a phone call away. And yes, you are getting paid. So that is where there's difference.
Well, there's also, I also say that there is a time for people that can just do it with a sponsor, you know, that, but the peer support is stuff like, you know, I need help finding housing.
Exactly.
Or I need help getting to a doctor's appointment or stuff like that. Stuff that, yeah, it'd be great to just have all the time in the world and go help people do this stuff. But it's stuff that, you know, it's even like in medicine stuff, sometimes you have to like add another, what would they call that? It's just a supplement.
An adjunct.
Yeah. And that's what it is. You know, it's just like going to church along with AA. You know, if that's the way that helps you. Everybody's different, and some people need that extra help.
And I think what I've noticed in the last, I don't know, since I started doing addiction medicine, so forever now, but AA, for at least what I observe, this is totally anecdotally, is there has been a little bit of shift. And, you know, early on, you know, AA is like sobriety. We are a abstinence-based goal. And if you take that very black and white abstinence-based goal, and you're talking something like an opioid use disorder, and we have, you know, OUD or medications for opioid use disorder, MAT, there are some old school AA tenant people who are, say you're not in recovery because you're still on a medication. And that's where the education, I think, piece is. And so what I would say is I understand where that's coming from in terms of the original 1935 tenants, where there wasn't hardly any medication at all, no. Let alone medications to help with an addiction. You know, because we have medications that help with alcohol use disorder too. The purpose of, and what makes someone have a use disorder versus someone who might just drink heavier or on and off, or a person who can just stop, is where it becomes an addiction is when it starts impacting your life. Right. You stop fulfilling your goals. You stop going to work. You stop being a good parent. You stop. It has to negatively impact your life.
Right.
So the medications are helping you just continue to achieve all the pro-social, pro-life things.
Right.
And so I think I have seen an evolution in that over time where it is more accepted. But I remember early patients would be like, I can't go to those meetings. I am literally frowned upon. It's like, definitely. Well, do you lie when the whole premise is being vulnerable and open? We had to create a different meeting for patients on MAT in our community.
Yeah.
At one point.
I mean,
I would tell people, if you're really wanting to do AA, which, you know, is great, and you go to one meeting and you're just not feeling comfortable with it, find a new one. There's so many.
That's the big part. That's what everybody says, is like, keep trying until you find one that works for you. And that's the big part, is that everybody's got different personalities. And a lot of time, these groups have been together for a long time, and people come in and then they realize they like it, and then other people don't. And so then it ends up being this nucleus of people. And maybe you don't mix with them, you know, so I would say then you don't like totally say AA is not for me or NA is not for me. It's just one of those things where, you know, but most of them, I would say most of them are so welcoming, you know, they just know. It's like, you know, these are my people. And there's no judgment. And you know what? I saw that evolution too, because when I went to treatment in 2011, they had us go to a meeting, outside meeting, and then they also had people from the other meeting, like they don't have like you know, hierarchy, but somebody that was like on the board of the group, that, you know, the local group, would come in and talk and host an AA meeting in the unit.
Sure.
And I remember one of them really staunchly against MAT, because mm-hmm. that was what was being started at the treatment center that I was at. And they're like, you don't, that's not recovery. You don't, you have to go through that hell I went through.
It's the whole initiation yeah, thing that, yeah. you know, you don't get to be part of this
fraternity
sorority. You have to right. earn it. Well,
and that, I think that was so, it was new. It was 2011.
Well, and I think, yeah, that was way early. And I think the other thing is now, even opposed to 2016, when I started having patients with, you know, for Suboxone and stuff, is the meetings, especially in a small town, they were all AA, and you'd go into a meeting and yeah. you're a person who's, you know, using heroin and everyone in there is using alcohol, and you lose a little bit of that common ground.
Yeah.
Yes, the addicted mind, the behaviors and blah, blah, blah are very similar, but I think on first welcome, there's differences. And sometimes people will look down like, well, use heroin, shoot, you know, whatever. But I think that has totally adjusted as well. I think from what I hear from patients is that it's more of a kind of a mixed bag depending on where yeah. you go.
Right.
You know, if you're going to move into a community where that specific meeting on that specific day of the week is all the 80-year-old guys who've been in recovery forever. I'm just picturing my grandpa because he used to go to these. I can out him because he's no longer living. And I have his original AA book. I just got to find it.
That's awesome.
It's super cool. It probably would crack at the, you know, the binding would probably crack and the pages will fly out. That would not go well for a person who's 20 years old. And I think that's why there are so many meeting options.
Right.
Like even in the small community, I mean, there's a lot of meeting options, which I think maybe we should talk about how to find one.
Well, that was a great point, because I was just thinking when you said there's all these meeting options, I have an app on my phone. Again, I'm probably just, I go, okay? And I'll just say that there's a lot of people that are in celebrities that say it, and we're probably going to highlight one later. But I will tell you that there is an app, and you can just go on your whatever Apple Store or where you get your apps, and just type in AA meetings, and it comes up, and it's a blue chair, or it's a blue thing with a white chair in it, and it says meeting guide, and it will, you, if you share your current or your location, it will give you a list of what meetings are the next one in time wise, and then where it's at, and how many miles away it is from you. And it'll give you the address, everything. And so it's remarkable that they have this. And it is a game changer, because if you're having a desire to drink, you know, and you don't want to, you can open up your phone. And if you live in a big city, I mean, you could probably throw a rock and find one.
Right.
You know, there's all these clubhouses, they call them. And you can go in there and they're just playing cribbage. And you don't, it doesn't
even though it's not like an official meeting time.
Right. It's just like a general area.
And like a little community center.
It is. It's
a safe place.
And it is so remarkable to see these people that at one point were so miserable and wanting to die, really, just enjoying life with each other, you know?
The fellowship,
if you
will. And then if you're traveling, that's huge. Because some people, you know, we were talking about Bill Wilson, you know, traveling salesman stockbroker, whatever they called him. You're in different communities, which can be triggers. You're sitting in a hotel, you're alone. We can put a whole list of things in there that would be high risk, especially for alcohol, where it's accessible everywhere, to have some place to go. So, you know, for people who are, you know that those are triggers, look it up ahead of time, like right. before I travel here. And now, most of the conferences that I go to are addiction related. And even in our brochures of here's all your high-level Harvard researchers lectures, there are three meetings offered every day at Addiction Society for the doctors and nurses and whomever. There are three meetings a day that they list right in their schedule.
And because it's important for some people, they need them daily. You know, and that's the other thing, you know, to mention is like, it doesn't have like this blueprint of how much you need to use it. I mean, you need to use it however much you need to use it. Right. And some people go daily.
Well, and, you know, things that you hear and is that some people, it's almost like going to the salon for some women, you know, like that's just like, I love going there. You just sit there and it's just like calm and peaceful. And it's almost like a life reset.
Yeah,
it is. You know, it's like going to the gym where you just kind of get this, take a breath. You know, it's going out for coffee. I kind of likened it to when I used to run at 5:10 in the morning with a group of girls. Like, yeah, we were running. We were getting exercise. I couldn't tell you how fast we were running. I mean, I could, but most of them couldn't because I was obsessive. But it was just having that fellowship. You know, we would talk about anything and everything, good, bad, and ugly. And it was just that set your day right. Or if you run at the end of the day, just kind of reset it. And so it's kind of like that. And, you know, we always talk about in, you know, from my perspective, looking, you know, as a provider in addiction medicine is you have to, your addiction comes first or your recovery comes first, I should say, because unless your recovery is solid, the rest of your life isn't. And I think what happens with patients is, you know, that lead to return to use is, okay, I've been to treatment, I've been sober for 6 months and things are going great. And then, you know, society and the world's like, okay, now you need a job and then you need a house and then you need to build this relationship back and then you need this relationship back. And we all know life gets busy and crazy. And then the next thing you know, they've returned to use. And so although some may look at it as a little selfish, like every day or once a week, I have a meeting. Well, that's keeping that person
accountable.
Accountable. I don't like the word accountable. It sounds so punitive if you don't. Yeah. It just keeps them
centered
in, you know, acknowledging their recovery as a positive. I am in recovery. Okay, that comes first, because if my recovery isn't there, everything else falls apart.
Right.
And so it's looking at it that way. So if you have a loved one and you're like, oh my gosh, they got to go to another meeting, they're just trying to get out of doing the dishes. Well, maybe there's a little bit of that, but at the same time, they're home, mm-hmm. You know, they're eating dinner as a family. And I think that's so important. And, I had a patient way early on who really didn't like meetings. Again, totally different drugs of choice. And this was 2016 and struggled and would get out. And then they'd like, here, you have to go to meetings. Like the courts would say, you have to go. And those, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. But what he kind of found out was he needed his 5 minutes. Like it kind of just became his 5 minutes. So he didn't go to meetings, but every single day he had 5 minutes. He would just go sit somewhere by himself and have to like, he would just almost intentionally meditate about and have, you know, gratitude about his recovery. And that worked for him. He just was not a group type person. Sure. And everybody knew every day he needed 5 minutes. This is the ability to sit with other people who maybe share how they got through something that you're like, oh my gosh, I am actually going through that too. That person just helped me. You know, it's
because it's not like you go in and it's every day is war stories.
Right.
You know, that's the thing that
movies always make it look like.
I always thought, you know, or I'm just going to go in here and listen to this person talk about how bad it was, you know, and how many drugs they sold and how, you know, all this. And I realize now it's not like that. It's just sharing your life, you know, talking about current situations. Like you just said, I'm going through something and maybe I'm going to hear about somebody that's going through something similar.
So I'm going to ask a couple of questions that are just more vague. Does everybody at a meeting have to share? I mean, no. You go around, you say your name and stuff, whatever, but like you don't have to share.
You can pass, you know, and a lot of times, the meetings have specific topics or you'll read about something, the daily reflection, stuff like that. And then you go off of that. But anybody can say at any time, I've got something that's pressing and I need to get it off my chest, you know, or something like I had a return to use and now I'm back. I'm on day one. I need help. You know, stuff like that.
Sure.
But you don't have to.
The reason I ask that, because, you know, you have people that like, I am an introvert. I am not going to go sit with a bunch of people and tell about the thing I have probably the most shame about in my life. Like, mm-hmm. Not going to happen. And so sometimes it's okay to just listen. And you might, like you said earlier, just catch one thing that really might help.
It can be a game changer. Or you might meet somebody, the person that, you know, that actually can get through to you or understand you, because there's I've said it many times that I suffered or still suffer in a way from terminal uniqueness, where I don't think that there's anybody that can help me because I'm too unique. Nobody, and not in a good way, really. It is kind of an egocentric type of a statement, but I never thought that anybody could understand me, and you know, and therefore, why am I going? But when you go, you see that there are more people that experience life the way you have, and probably have some good insight. And it's like dropping that wall. You know, I said it the other night, in your addiction, you know, you're building these walls because you are hiding from the world. And just because you stop using or stop drinking, that just means you stop building walls. You didn't break down the walls yet. And meetings are a way, essentially, to break down the walls. It's not the only way, but it's a way. So that's why I think there are things such as like dry drunks, where they just stop drinking, but they're miserable. And people probably know about that. People probably have seen people like that. It's the meetings, or it's the treatments, or it's the fellowship, or it's the the faith organization that you get involved with. It's whatever it is. Those are the ways that the walls are broken down, because you have to be willing to acknowledge that there is help, you know. And that's one of the first three parts of the steps is that, well, A, you acknowledge you have a problem, but B, that there's a higher power that can help. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about now, is that one of the other things that I've heard as a big reason why people don't want to go is that I don't believe in God. Mm-hmm. I am not going because they say the word God in their steps and everything. Well, I just want to say this. There is a whole chapter devoted to the agnostic in the Big Book. So if that's what's holding you up, I would encourage you to look into that. You can find it anywhere. But the key is that do not let that be the reason you do not get help.
Right.
I mean, that's why.
I mean, that's just one tenet for somebody, or one tenet of, you know, there's a lot of ways people achieve recovery. We know AA has been around forever and it works, and it's, the whole concept is connection and community. And yes, there's this, what's the first step? I acknowledge that I am
powerless over,
and
my life had become unmanageable.
Yeah. So, and then like, doesn't it say I'm giving everything to God, like in the next step or something like that? But it doesn't have to be God. It can be whatever spirituality. It can be, you know, the zodiac sign. It can be whatever. And spirituality and agnostics still have something that, even it's the absence of spirituality, is still a kind of a spirituality in itself.
Well, and as long as we start it, I'll just say the first three steps is really what I really wanted to focus on as far as the information. So that people know, it's the first step is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, or you can sub in drugs or whatever, and that our lives have become unmanageable. I think anybody could say that about anything in their lives. I admitted I am powerless over shopping.
I am powerless over food and exercise.
I'm powerless over thinking. I'm powerless over control.
Right.
And their lives become unmanageable. Basically saying that the alcohol has caused your life become unmanageable, and you're powerless over making the decision to stop.
Right.
The second step is came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So they're still not mentioning the word God. It's now right. In the third step is when...
Well, and a power greater than oneself can be the power of community and fellowship and partnership
and that
family
is,
and whatever.
That is very much debated within the walls, because they want it to not be... Like some people would say, your higher power could be that doorknob, you know? And it's real loose, and I don't agree with that either. But you know, they just say it's something outside of you, and but I'll explain more what I think they were getting at. The third step was made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So
there's where God comes in.
That's where God comes in. And this is the thing is that, you know,
well, what to me, can I just say what it says to me?
Sure.
And I had a really hard time with faith for many, many, many years. So I would have been the one being like, I'm not going to, hey, my God, they're going to just talk about God the whole time. Like that would have been me. That is right. Exactly what I would have said. How I look at that now from a person who's probably said that or would say that is, we're, you know, this says, yeah, I'm giving my power to God and whatever. It doesn't have to, it can be, I'm giving, all it is relinquishing of that control.
Right.
And that can just be, I'm going to stop trying to overly control, because think about it. If you tell yourself, don't eat the cake, don't eat the cake, don't eat the cake, you don't stop thinking about eating the cake. And that's like what happens with alcohol. Okay, I'm not going to have that first drink. I'm not going to have the first drink. And then you start fixating on it. Well, you're going to give in 99.99% of the time.
Right.
So it's trying to get rid of that need to control the behavior. So then you quit fixating on it and end up doing the behavior.
Right. And that's, and that's that, like you said, that release of control of trying to control that. Because it's all it's on your mind. That everybody's got those first three steps are always hard. I mean, if you think about it, really, I mean, these are all thinking ones. There's no real action. It's all just like in your head. And
we like control.
And you have to be honest with yourself. That's the thing, is that are you sure that you are admitting you are powerless? You know what I mean? Does that make you can say it all day long, but are you really buying into that?
Right.
And that's the part that trips people up. Is it, are you really buying into these steps? You know, or are you using the program as a crutch? I don't know. It's all about your amount of effort in this program. Right. And that's with anything, really.
Right. And I don't think it has to be looked at as I need to fully 100% the first time or second or 10th time I go to a meeting, I have to fully embrace that I am fully in, all in with steps 1, 2, 3, whatever. No.
There's no requirements.
There's no requirements. So you can participate in it without, and actually in one of these early pamphlets from like, this one was actually copyrighted in 1960 something. It actually says in here with the suggested 12 steps. Like it doesn't even say you have to, which I think for me, I like because I hate black and white. Like you have to do the 12 steps. This just says the suggested 12 steps to recovery from alcoholism. So let's talk a little bit about, just because we keep saying alcohol, because that's
one of the things that that is done is that it's in the big book and it talks about how it works. And I just want to read this part to you so that you hear what the premise is. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living, which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest.
And so that's there's nothing about God in that. It's just giving up control and being honest.
Mm-hmm. That's the hard part, is being honest about where you're at. You know, do you really want to stop?
Well, do you really think you, I don't say have a problem, do you really think you are powerless to the substance?
That's, I mean, people don't want to admit that because there's a weakness that is associated with that.
Well, plus admitting that and then now you're like, okay, now, you know, a logical brain might think, okay, well then I have an issue. I should probably not do that issue. You just gave up your number one coping mechanism too.
Right.
So not only did I just have to get honest about this thing I've been fighting because I'm denying and denying that I, you know, I'm addicted to alcohol or whatever. Now, not only do I not like had give that up. Now I have to also learn how to deal with life
right.
without that coping mechanism. So that's all scary. Right. That's like two big changes in one's life in one statement.
And you're putting it out there, really. I mean, I get it, it's anonymous, but you know, you're saying, a lot of people will shy away. You know, I'm usually drinking at the bar or whatever. I'm usually drinking at this event and people see me. It's like with pregnant women, you know, people mm-hmm. notice if you're not drinking.
Right.
And they ask you why you're not drinking. I'm like, well, you know, that's one thing that people had shame over. It's like, what do I say? You know, I say, well, I've had enough over my life in order, you know, to get this whole town drunk. So I'm done. Or they could say I'm in AA or I'm quitting drinking. Well, the one thing that is, if you do say that, then people will know. And if you do.
I just don't drink, people are going to just automatically assume, oh my gosh, you're an alcoholic or whatever.
Yeah.
I think luckily society has kind of shifted away from that a little bit, but I get it. That self-acknowledgement right. and the fear of being shamed or whatever it might be.
And I always said, you know, I was a teacher and I always said, isn't it funny that I feel more judged and this was me, you know, projecting, but I don't want people to see me coming out of an AA meeting, but I'd have no problem them seeing me coming out of a bar.
Right.
Isn't that crazy? Like you're just trying to, like, it's in a church and it's on an 8:15 night on a Sunday or on Monday night, and people are going, "What is Mr. Solomon going into that church at 8:15? Who cares?"
You know, right? Like
that's the part that kind of gets me about the program is that I get the premise of the anonymity thing, but we shouldn't have to live in the shadows and we shouldn't have to live in shame. When this program was developed, this was a very shamed thing.
Right.
People thought they were crazy.
Well, you don't want, though, I think a lot of the anonymity is that, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas kind of concept. Like, you are vulnerable. We just talked about that, being honest and vulnerable. And then you don't want, I mean, that's a huge thing with AA, is to then walk out of there and talk about what somebody else said. Like, you just don't do that.
Right.
And so it's almost twofold with that.
Well, and back then, I mean, as man, you know, like, it was mostly men, but there were women. There was, I think, a handful of women that helped create the steps themselves.
Well, somebody had to keep everybody on track.
Good point. Mm-hmm. But I think that back then it was like admitting you're powerless was
not manly.
Not manly. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like crying. What do you mean you can't control your alcohol? You know, it's just almost like as shaming as, you know, you won't drink. Like, I know my dad didn't drink, and I always thought that was strange because my uncles would drink, and I don't remember, but I don't think that it was always accepted. You know,
right. It's like, why? Well, my grandpa, like I said, he was an AA. He stopped drinking in 1980, I believe, so he would have been 52, I think, by the time he quit drinking. And he was not a pleasant drunk, and I can just, watching him in dementia, I can only guess how that was. He never had alcohol my whole life. But my grandpa's house, like, he lived in since the 50s or whatever, and there was a bar in their basement, like a really nice bar, actually, especially for a house of that age and whatever. That was never updated, but it was a really nice bar in the basement. And I have pictures of my grandpa and grandma, like, at all these
parties,
drinking parties. Like, they were like top society back then, and it's like I remember asking him about that. Now, granted, by the time I was born, like, this was well beyond that, and I never, like, he had a couple friends, like a couple close friends that he never went out with at, you know, at any time. Like, and I knew he didn't drink. Like, this was a known thing, and I said, well, do you miss it? Like, I asked him one time, and he's like, no, like, I was not a good person, or, you know, I was not a good dad when your mom and her sisters were kids. But he said it back then it was hard because, like, they lost their entire social circle.
Right.
And
that's what everybody did.
That's what everybody did. And it wasn't like now, if you have a friend that doesn't drink, like, it's no big deal. Like, if anything, you joke being like, oh, we have a designated driver all the time, whatever. But they're still welcome to come with, and they're included. And I've never seen it be an issue. Like in college, I didn't drink much because I didn't want to be stuck anywhere. So I was usually the designated driver, not because I didn't want to be stuck anywhere. And I had just as much fun as everybody else did. And I think that's probably different now. But back in the 70s and 60s, if you weren't drinking, like people looked at you with
they looked at you differently. Yes,
a problem. Or
and if you think about back in the 30s. You know, if you're a traveling salesman or, you know, if you admit, but like maybe the drinking was, again, I'm a history teacher, so I should know this, but when prohibition dates actually were, but I think back then it was a manly thing, you know, to be able to drink. And even for women who do drink, it was just a sign of weakness to say that I can't drink. Not that I choose not to drink, but that I can't because I won't be able to handle myself. And that's a big distinction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's admitting to something that, you know, let's face it. Nobody wants to put something in your body and then become a monster. You know, that is not something people want to do. So when people are confused as to why people would do that, it's because they're sick.
Interesting. Sorry, I'm looking back. Canada had prohibition before the U.S. The Faroe Islands had, Denmark had prohibition first. I mean, Russia had prohibition from 1914 to 1925. Iceland did. Like, a lot of them started in the 19-teens and went until the 1920s to, oh my gosh, Denmark was all the way up until 1992, actually. The United States prohibition, 1920 to 1933. So it had just ended in 1935. Yeah. So I can only imagine that the alcohol went way up after prohibition ended. So now we're going to do this after that.
Yeah, and you know, and it wasn't too long after the war, the big war. And you know, it's, I think alcohol was just being used in many different ways, many different settings, but people were starting to become more outgoing, you know, like more thing, you know, when you think about the revolutionary, you know, with cars and with buildings, and you know, we're not on Little House on the Prairie anymore. You know, there's actually social interaction, there's things to do, there's like the, what do they call them, the flappers, the dance, there's like a dance dress.
Yes,
but it, you know, it's just things started to change and alcohol started to become a part of it. And people started to realize that alcohol didn't always have the best results. You know, people started to make decisions that they weren't proud of.
Right.
So making this, you know, making the distinction and having guys like Bill and Bob decide that they have a problem has changed the world.
Right.
Changed the absolute world. And I look at, you know, if I just want to mention this quick. We're going to wrap up here because we're going to try and keep this one under an hour for the first time in probably 18 episodes. But there are so many spinoffs of the 12-step program, and I'm just going to list off a couple. There's Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, which is friends and family members of alcoholics. Al-Ateen, obviously, is for the youth, which those are very they're very successful. It's just you got to find the right one. There's NA, Narcotics Anonymous, AAA, AAA, All Addictions Anonymous, CA, Cocaine Anonymous, CMA, Crystal Meth Anonymous, MA, Marijuana Anonymous, there's a nicotine one, there's Gamblers Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, Sexaholics Anonymous, there's like a bunch just for sex things. There's Depression Anonymous, Depressed Anonymous, Dual Diagnosis Anonymous,
I mean, I think the ones that are most...
Eating Addictions Anonymous, Eating Disorders Anonymous. I mean, they are very pinpointed if you need that.
Right.
You know, that's,
now,
that's
they're the not going to be as universally located, of
course, but not at all. But I mean, you're looking in Chicago, you could find probably all of these.
Right. So, I mean, if we're talking most places, you're going to have your AA, you're probably going to have...
NA.
An NA. You might have an Al-Anon.
Yeah, probably in that order. Maybe the Al-Anon before NA.
Right.
But there's definitely, I mean, AA is the big one, and that's the thing about it is you can go there and they're not going to tell you to go away. They're really not. against popular belief. They're not going to push you away.
Right.
So I think that's what we'll end up. But I do think that we should just go through the steps on one of the future episodes. And if anybody wants to come on as a guest and talk about AA, we would love to have that.
I might have somebody actually when you said that. Okay, our celebrity highlight. We're going way back. We're going to The Godfather. Al Pacino. I just liked his quote he said about AA, so I went with it. He's 83 now. Did you know that?
I knew he was up there.
He's actually won the Triple Crown of Acting. The Academy and the Emmy.
Yeah.
So he's pretty up there. He started smoking and drinking alcohol at age 9, marijuana by 13. Not ironically in a good way, two of his best friends from childhood died of overdoses, one at age 19 and one at age 30. Kind of grew up a troublemaker, raised by a single mom who had cousins and grandparents all in his house, didn't graduate high school, really into the arts even back then. Had a rough year when he was 22. His mom and his maternal grandfather, who were like two of his closest people, both died within a year. And so he just had a lot of difficulties for a while. And then all of a sudden he hit it big with the Godfather role.
Yeah.
And that was like his big
thing.
That
was his breakout.
It was his breakout. 1972 is when that came out. He actually was nominated for Best Actor for the Academy Awards the following year. So it would have been 1973. And he actually, there's a couple quotes or statements that he said he was really glad he didn't win, because he said he would have probably not been able to get on the stage. That's how inebriated and he was gone. So he's glad he didn't win, but he really struggled after The Godfather because he rose to fame so fast.
Yeah.
And he actually, just the whole experience of making The Godfather and then the fame component of it really catapulted his drinking to help with him cope with, Hollywood and all that. Actually had to go to mental health therapy as well. 5 days a week, he met with a therapist after that, just with all of it on top of it. Decided to quit drinking in 1977. So not that long after. He said he doesn't remember really the 70s at all. I guess up until 1977. So in 1977, there weren't a ton of options. And so what he says is, quote, "I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not ashamed of that. I did not start their program, but I found it very supportive and meaningful. I did stop drinking, not immediately, but I did stop." So, his quitting ended up just being because people started to have a little concerned about him, but it wasn't like some catastrophic major car accident kind of crash.
Right.
People were able to identify it. And so he went to AA initially because he had the desire to quit drinking. And it, took a bit, doesn't say how long, but he eventually did and has not drank since.
That's the story. I mean, that's really what AA is about, is that, he said, I went, I didn't stay sober right away. But
he actually says, "I'm not ashamed either." And that was 1977.
That's back then. That's pretty big. But
and he was The Godfather.
Right.
And he was in movies. I didn't go super far down the rabbit hole this time. I was proud of myself. But he played roles after that of people who were like, one of them, cocaine.
Right.
It was who he played.
Tony Montana
So he played a lot of roles where he had to get triggered.
He had to be, like he was under the influence.
Right.
He was in a lot of roles where he would be drinking, And that's the thing is that we don't think about this when we look at people in the spotlight. We don't think about what their life is like outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say you had to see a therapist like 5 times mm-hmm. a week? I mean, that's serious stuff. And so, of course, everybody is affected and is tempted to use drugs or alcohol to soothe their stuff. We're not alone. Mm-mm. Nobody's alone, and. Just that's the
greatest actors of all time.
Yeah. And the whole premise of AA is to reach out and get help from your fellows. So we forgot to mention at the beginning, but you're going to hear a little spiel at the end, unless you've listened long enough to know that you want to shut it off. Ben, we're right done. But I want to remind everybody to please go on and like this podcast, follow us, maybe find our Facebook and follow us there so that you can see when a new episode is released. and then share that with your friends, because we feel like there is so much good, valuable information that is
mostly brought by our guests.
Yes, right. Our guests are the stars. But I think it's so important that it gets out there. So I'm so grateful that we have this. I'm so grateful for Dr. Heather Bell. She's the brains behind this.
You got the experience. I just fake it.
Yeah, right. But yeah, well, thank you, everybody. And we really appreciate it, and any input about this. And if anybody's really familiar with AA and wants to like correct me on anything, please email us. We want any type of feedback. So God bless. Thank you.
Working together, we can move addiction to recovery.
If you would be so kind, please go to wherever you listen to your podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating, possibly a comment, but for sure click to follow us so you never miss an episode. Most importantly, don't forget to share our episode with a friend.
And as always, if you would like to ask us a question, have a topic recommendation, or would even want to be a guest on our show, email us at addiction2recoverypodcast@gmail.com. That's addiction2recoverypodcast@gmail.com.
Or follow us on Twitter at A2RPodcast, or on Facebook or Instagram at Addiction to Recovery Podcast.